So what I'm going to try to do is focus on what are the things that you, the patient, need to know about subcutaneous immune globulin, and also kind of wrap up what Mark and I are saying in terms of what you as a patient should know about gamma globulin and its risks and its benefits. So I'm conflicted, and everybody knows that. So the use of subcutaneous gamma globulin isn't anything that's new. As a matter of fact, they've been using it in Sweden for a number of years because it was easier to administer and in many cases safer to administer because they had problems with contamination of their products. So if you look at the use of gamma globulin worldwide, and this is from a review article that Steve Jolies and I wrote back in 2011, you can see that, for example, if you look at patients with antibody deficiency in Sweden, about 80% of them are using sub-Q as opposed to 20% in that country. And in the U.S. At that time, it was about 30% of patients with antibody deficiency received sub-Q versus the other 70% receiving IV. That number has shifted toward a higher usage of subcutaneous gamma globulin over the last few years, and we're going to talk about that. So at the present time, there are about 5 products that are available in the United States that are approved by the FDA for subcutaneous. They include the GammaKid product, which is a 10% solution, and it needs to be administered weekly. The Gamunex C, which is also a 10%, and it's used weekly. GammaGuard, which is made by Baxter, and that's used weekly. And the thing about these two is it's the same product and they can be administered either sub-Q or IV. So what that means for you is that you could be on not have to switch products, but be on, say, Gamunex C some of the time and switch over to IV or sub-Q and back again without having to switch products. Now, the other products, the Hizentra, which is made by CSL, and the newly approved Hycuvia, can only be administered subcutaneously. Hizentra, in contrast to the other ones, is a 20% solution, so that means you only have to use half the volume as you would compared to a 10% solution. Now, there's a huge amount of confusion about sub-Q dosing, and the doctors are more confused than the patients, and it has to do with the wonders of the FDA. So the FDA consists of little people that they're in small little cubicles in Washington, D.C., who play with pencils all day long. And they have these things called area under the curve, and their pharmacologists love this. So if you look at I'm sorry I don't have a pointer. If you look at that peak when it goes up and then it drops down. Well, when Dr. Ballo and I dose our patients for IV gamma globulin, we bring that peak up so that we never go below a certain level in our trough. So that means we overshoot the level of IgG we want during the first few weeks of the infusion so that we never drop down to a lower dose below that threshold we want to be. Because the half-life of IgG is about 28 days. So we give it, we overshoot, and it goes down. So if you cut off the top of that peak and you turn it over, the area under that curve is slightly higher than the trough level we want. So when we give subcutaneous, it's sort of leaching out into the tissue, so we don't have the peaks and trough, as you can see in that, but the area under the curve is slightly higher. So when the FDA looked at the calculations, and this is all done by calculus, they came up with dosing changes when you went from an IV product to a sub-Q product. So what this means is that when we look at the bioavailability of subcutaneous products, and this is true for all products, they're about two-thirds of what you would be if you were to give that same product IV. So there are some differences in the dosing. We need to do some adjustments. But remember, every patient is their own individual, so we want to make sure that we're on the right dose that's for you so that we maintain an IgG steady state level that will keep you from getting infections. So the guidelines we use for the treatment of subcutaneous guidelines is that we take the monthly dose and divide it into weekly or alternate weekly or monthly administrations, depending on what that dose is, and then we make a dose modification. And that dose modification could be 1.37, as it's recommended by the FDA for some products, or 1.51, as it's recommended by the FDA for other products, or it might be 1-to-1. So, but the important thing is what your numbers are and what your levels of infections are. Then we take that volume. So let's say you have 90 grams or 80 grams, it's easier, 80 grams or 80 cc's of IVIG, and you split that up into four equal parts and administer it weekly. Or some products you could break it in half and give 40 grams every other week. And then you want to give that infusion either in the soft tissues of the abdomen, the thighs, the flank, or the upper arms. And then the amount we can give in each site can vary from about a tablespoon or 15 mLs up to 25 mLs. Now, the new medication called Hycuvia can actually take a larger volume, as up to 200 or 400 mLs, and that's why we can give that once a week. And then we administer it with a smaller needle, either a 9 or 6 or a 12 millimeter needle that's either a 24 or 27 gauge, which is about the size of an insulin needle. And then we infuse that either through a pump, or some patients actually push it themselves. Now, in terms of the dosing, the important thing to remember is what's the right dose for you. And this is what's called a meta-analysis, so each little circle represents an individual study where we looked at the IgG steady-state level sub-Q and looked at the number of infections. And what you can see from this is that in those patients who had higher trough levels, they tended to have a lower number of infections per patient per year. And that's important because it's your body, therefore you should be dosing it at the level that keeps you from getting infections. So it's a combination of what your level is and a combination of what your health is that determines what your optimal dose is. So the way the stuff is infused is either through a battery-powered pump with, onto a syringe that's called a driver, or what most folks use is a wind-up pump called a Freedom 60 pump, where it's just a spring-loaded thing that pushes the gamma globulin in relatively slowly. It's very, very important that you understand that we're going into the subcutaneous tissues. Now, this is not an intradermal injection. It's a subcutaneous injection. That means we have to pop the needle through the skin, and then it goes into the subcutaneous layer, that layer of spongy tissue between your skin and your muscle if you pinch an inch on your abdomen. You don't want to go into the muscle because that hurts, and you don't want to go into the dermis, into the skin, because that's going to cause irritation. So you want to go into that subcutaneous tissue. Now, the subcutaneous tissue is spongy, and it's held together by these kind of vines called hyaluronic acid. They're kind of like threads. And that keeps the IgG from moving freely in the subcutaneous space. So what Baxter did with the idea of Hycuvia is they have an enzyme called hyaluronidase that breaks up the threads and allows the IgG to flow freely into the subcutaneous space. And that represents, sort of an innovation for the use of subcutaneous immune globulin. But the spots that you can use, those fleshy spots on your arms, on your abdomen, and your thighs, where you can get a tablespoon or more of fluid into the subcutaneous space without too much irritation. So this is what a typical injection site would look like. And as the infusion goes in, there's some redness and you get kind of a dimple over the site. It itches and sometimes it burns, and that usually begins, that's usually when you first start using it. By the end of the infusion, that irritation has gone away, and within 24 hours you might feel a little bit of a pooch, but really not very much at all. 92% of patients will experience some kind of local site reaction, particularly during the early part of when you first start the infusion. You get used to it after a while, but it will itch and it will burn to some extent, but most of the time it's very mild. The big advantage of subcutaneous immune globulin compared to intravenous is the number of patients who get those severe systemic reactions, the terrible headaches, the malaise, the fever. That almost goes away. It's not zero, but it almost goes away completely when you use subcutaneous gamma globulin. As with all IVIG products, it is contraindicated in patients who have sensitivity to IgA. So what we do in our wave of administering subcutaneous immune globulin is we go through a training program where you come into the office and you'll get your first four or five injections under the watchful eye of one of our nurses like Deb, who knows what to look for and teach you how to do it. Now, some of the infusion companies, the home health companies, have really got good skilled nurses, and they can do this in the home. So it doesn't necessarily have to be in the physician's office for all of the procedures. But like I said, if you're going to have problems, it's going to be in the first four or five administrations. After that, you can transition to self-infusion. You're completely independent of a nurse, completely independent of a doctor. And most of the times, I don't see my subcutaneous patients maybe twice a year, and I check their steady-state IgGs, and then they call me if they have problems. And then during that time, we'll check the steady-state IgG. And the really neat thing is you don't have to do it right before the infusion. You can get it any time because there's no fluctuation in that IgG level. So I say, go to LabCorp, get a lab done, bring it with you when you come to see me in clinic, and we'll see if we need to adjust the dose. Or sometimes we can do it over the phone. Now, there's a lot of troubleshooting that needs to go into giving gamma globulin. It takes a lot of skill to predict what those things are going to be. And there's actually a session this afternoon on troubleshooting for subcutaneous immune globulin. But I'm just going to go over some of the things that we see, which are the injection site reactions, some of the leaking that occurs, extreme discomfort associated with the needles. Are the infusion taking like hours when it should only take about 45 minutes to an hour and a half? Are having blood return? Those are the things that we look for when we're giving the infusions, and those are things that you should call us about, and we can help walk you through if you're having a problem. Now, the next few minutes I'm going to talk about what everybody should know about subcutaneous immune globulin. Now, how many of you have ever actually read the product information for medications that you receive? You are the exceptions. This is what was in my room this morning. Okay? All right? And you know what font this is? I had to look it up. It's like 5. So there's no way, even with the 3-diopter glasses that I have, that I can read this. But buried in here is the FDA black box warning that everybody should know about if you're receiving a gamma globulin product. Now, the first thing is that all gamma globulin products, sub-Q, IG, whether you receive hepatitis B, IG, if you get exposed to hepatitis B in Thailand or something, all gamma globulin products have this activated factor 11, and there is a risk for thrombosis. The higher the dose, the higher the risk. Patients have to be closely monitored for the risk of developing hemolytic disease because there's some antibodies against red blood cells in the products, and that can activate things. You have to be careful for evidence of what they call pulmonary leak syndrome and hemolysis and other things, again, when it's given in high dose. But you need to be aware of these risks when you receive your gamma globulin, because oftentimes your physician won't advise you against these things. And then any human plasma-derived product carries a theoretical risk for a possible infection, and Mark has already told you that that's low. So, what patients should know about gamma globulin before starting treatment. First thing, as we've already alluded to, is that IVIG and sub-QIG are derived from pooled human plasma, and they come from U.S. donors at U.S. donor plasma centers. Thrombosis and renal failure are the major adverse event that can occur. That the products consist primarily of monomeric IgG, and the IgA and the IgM are actually removed. And most of the adverse events are related to the amount of the IgG dimers that Dr. Ballo discussed in the product. The products are generally very safe and thought to be pathogen-free because they go through this filtration process, and there's been no known transmission of HIV, and the transmission rate of prions is theoretical. The other thing that you should know about gamma globulin is the efficacy. That is, how well does it protect you from infections? When products are licensed by the FDA, the bar that they have to jump over is they have to cause less than one serious bacterial infection per patient per year. So what that means is it's skewed so that it's only protecting you from pneumonia and sepsis and meningitis and those really serious infections. But its efficacy to prevent sinusitis and ear infections and other things are not as strong. So this is actually a study that was done by the Immune Deficiency Foundation, and they looked at patients from the IDF in terms of how many infections they had the year before they started treatment and the year after treatment. So as you can see at the top, the risk of serious bacterial infections were very, very low, like 0.1 serious infections per year. But sinus infections, diarrheal infections, those sorts of things, although they decreased significantly, they did not go away. So many patients expect gamma globulin, sub-Q or IV, to be a panacea. I'm never going to have a sinus infection again. My kid's never going to have an ear infection again. But that's just not the case. We just don't have that penetration of the product into these mucosal surfaces to really 100% protect us. It's not the same as being a normal individual where you have IgA and IgM. So I'm going to skip over the black box warning. I'm just going to conclude with this last slide about the differences between IVIG and sub-Q IG. One is the efficacy of the two products are about the same. Patient preference varies. Well, they did a focus group when they first started rolling out subcutaneous globulin. I just ripped this up. Okay. Well, they did a focus group and they asked doctors what they would prefer. And actually we said, because I was part of the focus group, I'd rather get my gamma globulin once a month to be done with it. Okay. But there are other people that want to, you know, would rather not have to drive to the infusion center and see Finding Nemo for the 333rd time and get their four-hour infusion. So it really depends on you, okay? Some physicians would prefer gamma globulin products given IV all the time. Some would prefer them giving sub-Q, but the data really doesn't support one versus the other. Your mobility, and mobility I mean your ability to get to an infusion center, because that's a big deal for a lot of people. So, you know, if you don't have to drive 2 hours to get an infusion or you don't have access to good home health nursing, then sub-Q would actually be a pretty good choice for you. Compliance is the big one, moms and dads, because I've seen lots and lots of kids on stable on sub-Q. They go off to college, and given something once a week and trying to remember is sometimes difficult. Not in my patients, of course, but it is difficult for adolescents and teenagers, and it's also because you're on your own. There's no nurse to call you up. There's no reminder call. You have to remember it's Saturday afternoon. It's time to give yourself your sub-Q, because if you miss it, you're going to have pneumonia by Thanksgiving. The office visits and the cost is actually quite interesting. The cost of infusion centers are going up, so without having that nurse involved, your actual total cost could be lower if you go to sub-Q. So even though the product might be a little bit more expensive, the overall cost may be actually lower. IV access, big deal in pediatrics, big deal in the elderly. IVs are hard to get in some folks, and if you have to get stuck six times to get an IV in every single month, you might think about just doing an infusion because you can't miss your abdomen with a 9mm needle. And then systemic reactions are one of the main reasons that sub-Q evolved in the first place, because there are patients that were totally debilitated by getting IV that went on to sub-Q, and magically those headaches went away. So I'm going to stop, invite our Vanna White up here to take questions.